submanifolds and to talk about applying Gauss-Kadazi. So what we're going to look at today are two sort of aspects or formalisms in which Gauss-Kadazi is used. The first one is where we'll derive the Israel equations, which are a set of equations of motion for a codimension one submanifold when viewed as being some sort of physical object. So we saw earlier this week the domain wall, and we saw that that looked like some surface, hypersurface, living in space-time. But we also had a physical interpretation of the domain wall because we derived it from a non-perturbative solution in field theory. So the first application are the Israel equations, but then I also want to, having sort of used the Israel equations to motivate this notion of submanifolds as being physical or dynamical objects, I then want to go back to the Einstein-Hilbert action and look at the boundary and take a boundary term seriously, and then we'll see how to complete the Einstein-Hilbert action by adding a boundary term. So that's the Gibbons-Hawking term. So let's first of all talk about the domain wall. So in our domain wall, we had a direction z. It's not that the metric depended only on z, because the surfaces sort of z equals constant were not necessarily flat. As we saw, in fact, they were looked De Sitter-like, so they were actually a constant curvature space. But nonetheless, the essence of the domain wall was that it was strongly localized in a particular direction, which we called z. So let me just have a look at the Einstein equations, but trying to break them down in terms of things sort of orthogonal to z, and sort of lying in surfaces of z equals constant, and things perpendicular. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to look at this particular combination of the four-dimensional Riemann tensor with some vector n. Now, obviously, we've got in the back of our minds n is going to end up being a normal, and the reason I want to do this is because I'm going to see that I need to substitute for this term in the Gauss equation, but for the moment, I'm just going to manipulate it using the Ricci identity. So here, you see that I'm summing over this B index in the second entry here, which means that I can express this as the anti-symmetrized covariant derivative of N. So that's just by definition. But now let me look a little more closely. I'm now going to say that this N field is geodesic because I'm going to be using the fact that my n is a normal field. So suppose n is geodesic, then I can write it this way. And finally, this I can substitute my derivatives of n by the extrinsic curvature. So I've got this expression. But then if I look at my normal covariant derivative of k, I'm just going to tweak that a little bit, write it slightly differently. I'm going to replace my covariant derivative by a Lie derivative. And if I do that, I have to do it at the price of subtracting off some derivatives of k. So I've rewritten my Riemann tensor with two normal components in terms of extrinsic curvatures. So why did I want to do that? Well, what I really want to do is to start looking at the Einstein equations. I've written them in a slightly different format. I've written them in terms of sourcing the Ricci tensor there. And so for the wall, I saw when I computed my energy momentum tensor that to a very good approximation, there was no normal component of the energy momentum tensor, and all the parallel components were the same, or rather, it was proportional to the induced metric. So roughly speaking, this is what TAB looks like, but this sigma of Z was sharply localized. So if I look at that in the context of my Einstein tensor, that tells me I sort of expect the perpendicular component of the Einstein tensor to be more or less zero, and the parallel components to be the same or proportional to the metric. So that means that it makes sense to think about a sort of parallel Einstein equation and to look at what information that gives me. So let me just recall the Gauss equation that we derived. Pull that index downstairs. So that was our Gauss equation, and it's simply, I've taken the fact that my normal here is space-like, so I've only got one normal, so I've just got one k. So if I find the Ricci tensor, then the first term means I'm contracting on my four-dimensional Riemann tensor with the induced metric H, But if you remember, H is just G plus NN. So I get a four-dimensional Ricci tensor. And then I've got to add on the extrinsic curvature pieces. So now you can see why I wanted to compute that term, because now I can replace I can replace the Riemann term with the Lie derivative of my extrinsic curvature. And of course, this term here, my Einstein equations, I see that if I just use my Einstein equations here, I'm simply going to get 8 pi g TAB minus a half THAB. So what I've done is I've used the Gauss equation to kind of think a bit about a parallel component of the Einstein equations. Now, if my TAB then I can think of it as being approximately a delta function. So I'd more or less done that with the wall. Where the delta function was really this sec to the fourth, which is strongly localized. Mm-hmm. So this is just defining SAB. So this defines SAB. So by your sort of usual rules of the game for delta functions, you would say SAB is the integral of TAB. That's the sort of usual definition for the delta function. So if I now look at what I've got here, look at the different pieces, got another piece of colored chalk. This RBD term, it's an intrinsic curvature. So it's an intrinsic curvature of my submanifold, and therefore it's not going to particularly have a delta function. This is something that does not change much, as even if we spread out our wall or smooth out our wall, the parallel component or the intrinsic curvature does not blow up. So this is regular. as our width, if you like, the width of the object goes to zero. So what else is regular? Well, K is also regular because K is a property of sigma. So when we wrote down our extrinsic curvature, it wasn't sort of something that was distributional. So this is also regular, as is this. However, the Einstein part, the projection of my Einstein equations parallel to the wall, gives me things dependent on energy momentum. And I've argued that my energy momentum tensor, as I squish my wall down to zero thickness, is becoming more and more peaked. So this, I'll say singular, but what I mean is singular in a delta function sense. So this becomes strongly peaked. And therefore, this tells me since the only thing left in my equation is K, or the Lie derivative of K, is telling me that my extrinsic curvature had better also be strongly varying as I go through this wall. Otherwise, I've got nothing to counterbalance this very strong energy momentum tensor. So if I integrate this Gauss equation from one side of the wall to the other, these terms will give me something which is regular times the width of the wall, whereas these terms which will give me something which is order one. So these terms will be of order the width of the wall. These terms will be order one. So what I get when I integrate across the wall is I get something that looks like a kind of Einstein equation. It's telling me that my extrinsic curvature has to vary, so I look at the difference across the wall, and that difference has to be equal to this combination of the energy momentum tensor. So if I rearrange this, this tells me that if I take the trace, that the difference in K, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, is minus 4 pi s. So I find eventually the equivalent of the Einstein equations, but integrated out through a distributional source. So these are known as the Israel equations. So if I put in my wall energy momentum tensor, that would tell me that my extrinsic curvature had to be proportional to the induced metric. But when Israel derived these equations, he was interested in I guess he derived them in the 60s, so they didn't really know about domain walls in the 60s, at least not gravitationally. And so he was thinking more about sheets or surfaces in astrophysics, so a sort of shells of dust, because people wanted to sort of look at what, you know, what happened during gravitational collapse. And one way of exploring that analytically, because numerically was just not an option at that point, was to look at collapsing shells. And so if you want to do that analytically, then you know, you want to be able to describe a distributional source in general relativity. So that was what Werner Israel did. And nowadays, we tend to use it much more in the context for domain walls, or brains, as we call them. So the Israel equations are the Einstein equations for codimension one. And just to sketch what they're doing, what they're describing is a highly localized physical object, which is a hypersurface. And what we've done here is we've taken, this is N on normal field. So we've got some normal field, which is taking us through the wall, perpendicular to the wall. And this would be the minus side. This is the plus side. And I just want to note that the normal field is continuous in the Israel formulation because he was interested in a real physical object. And of course, a real physical object isn't going to have actual zero thickness. It's going to be finite thickness. Now, the thickness could be stupidly small, but it's still finite at some level. So here in the Israel formulation, the normal field is continuous. So I'm just stressing this point because when we go on to look at the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, we'll actually describe that where the normal field always points into the bulk. So I'm just emphasizing this now, that because this is something where, I mean, even now, and I've done these sort of calculations hundreds of times, I always sit and have to think, oh gosh, which sign is the normal? So, you know, if you end up getting a question on that, and with David around, anything can happen. So you might, don't worry if you get confused about signs of normals. That's absolutely normal. So let's do a check of this. So when I talked about the domain wall solution, which we derived just by manipulating the Einstein equations, writing down a metric and solving, we got... We got a solution that looked like it had a horizon, and I argued it was a horizon, that it wasn't a singularity, and I think failed to convince you that it really was just flat space and that the wall looked like a hyperboloid. So let's go back to that and pretend our domain wall is infinitesimally thin, and let me give you a bit more justification of what I actually said. So for the moment, I'm not going to sort of start from first principles with the wall. I'm simply going to look at a hyperboloid in Minkowski spacetime. So here is our time coordinate, and we have a radial coordinate, and the hyperboloid, of course, asymptotes a light cone. So it's defined by r squared minus t squared equals l squared. So I can represent this by a set of coordinates. So I can parameterize it by hyperbolic sines and cosines. So remember, this is writing sigma as x mu of sigma a, where my sigma a are tau theta phi here. So that's my surface, and I want to see what happens if I use Israel's equations on my surface. So let me look at my normal. So to get the normal to the surface, you're sort of looking for something. I chose this parameterization specifically here so that x dot mu squared had length 1, okay? You don't have to do that, but I wanted to do that. So this is a normal, and normal can have two signs, and the upper sign corresponds to a normal which is pointing into the hyperboloid. The lower sign corresponds to a normal pointing out of the hyperboloid, okay? So you see that because you've got to raise the index to look at the vector n, and then if I raise the index, the upper sign gives me a negative radial component, points inwards. So here, so I'll just note, not that we need it, but I'm just going to say that gamma AB is so that's just saying if I go through and look at the induced metric on my hyperboloid, I get De Sitter space. So you may have seen De Sitter space written as an embedding of a hyperboloid in a Minkowski spacetime of one dimension higher. So let me just compute one of the k's. I'm not going to worry about double checking that it is indeed, k is indeed proportional to the induced metric. I'll leave that to you if you want to check it. So my k theta theta is simply proportional to a single connection component. So I go through and calculate what that is. And then I input what my NR is. So R is L cosh tau on L, and N is cosh tau on L. So that's just equal to cosh squared. And so this is equal to minus or plus d theta theta divided by L. So that's sort of demonstrated, at least for the theta-theta component, I've got a constant of proportionality times g theta-theta. So now, if I keep the inside of a hyperboloid, and I assume that my wall is reflection symmetric, so this is where you get this sort of slightly paradoxical thing that you're keeping two interiors of a hyperboloid. then referring to this picture for Israel's equations, I've got to take an outward pointing normal on the minus side, an inward pointing normal on the plus side, and it's going to give me that k plus ab minus k minus ab, in this case would be twice k plus ab, so that's the Z2 symmetry. And so if I keep the inside, in that case, I get minus 2 over L, HAB, G. So therefore, delta K theta theta if I look at my delta KAB up there from my Israel equations, or rather a couple of steps beforehand, my SAB was just sigma HAB. The trace of S is therefore 3 sigma. So the left-hand side up there is minus 4 pi G sigma HAB. And so that tells me what my value of L is. So if you go back and replace what the energy per unit area is, and you'll see that that gives the same value as L that we derive for the domain wall. So just to get to my, so this agrees. To get to my original expression, I'm going to make a general coordinate transformation. And so if I do that, you'll see that I'll recover the metric that we derive for z greater than 0. So what we've really done here, if I resketch my R and T coordinates, these are my flat space radial coordinates. And what I've done, as I've said, I'm going to just shift coordinates to take hyperbole. And then for an orthogonal system, I end up with this coordinate system. So what I've done is I've taken a patch, sort of a quarter of a plane here, and I've re-coordinatized it using spatial coordinates constant along hyperbole and time coordinates constant along these straight lines that radiate out from the origin. So that's explicitly showing that the metric outside the wall is flat, but we wrote it in peculiar coordinates. So this, this sort of strange patch here is also known, or it's not quite Rindler, but it's sort of a Rindler space-time. So it's really where you take each of these z equals constant lines is the line of a uniformly accelerating observer. So that's what that looks like. So what this whole process has done and what the Israel equations do is they give a physical meaning to a submanifold, to some infinitesimally thin codimension one object. And so now we can go back to our Einstein-Hilbert action and calculation, and we can revisit it and see if we add a term on the boundary, can we make our variational principle close? In other words, can we make it work properly? So what I've done here is I've just written down again what we actually derived when we got the Einstein action. We got in our bulk, so that's the main part of the volume, we got the Einstein tensor times the variation of the metric. And then we got this boundary term, which was expressible in terms of normal derivatives. So what we want to do is we'd like to take this boundary term, which at the moment, if we apply a strict variational principle, we can't make that vanish because it depends on the way delta G extends into the bulk space-time. So let's look at adding a boundary term that will cancel off these normal derivatives. And we've got a sort of very clear candidate in the sense that we've got a scalar, which is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. So that's something that's scalar. It's something that depends on the submanifold, in this case, the boundary of M. It's also something that we've derived in terms of a formalism, the Israel equations. We've said that it actually has some physical content. But I think most importantly, the extrinsic curvature itself has an intuitive meaning to us. When I introduced it, I said, well, actually, this is usually the way in which we first meet curvature, and it's often our intuitive or people's intuitive notion of curvature until it's corrected by learning about the Riemann tensor and the Ricci tensor. So the extrinsic curvature, because it is intuitive, it's really something that's just out there begging to be used in some form or another. So it's a very natural scalar to apply. So let's have a look at what we can do with K. So our trace of the extrinsic curvature is the divergence of the normal. And if we're thinking about a variational principle, we would hold delta G fixed on the boundary. So that would be saying that our induced metric was fixed on the boundary. And so the normal, a variation of a normal field, would be telling us about the variation of the metric. So I'm going to take N to be space-like without any real loss of generality, but also because typically you might be considering what's happening inside a volume sort of through time. So you know how to change things if N is time-like. So what I need to compute is the variation of delta k. Well, I mean, I know what the variation of Ricci is, so I don't really need to work on that one. So the first piece, looking at delta Na, I know that delta Na is really just given by, in terms of normal components of delta G. So here I'm going to get I simply project down the normal derivative of delta G to get my delta N. And then the second term, remember that the sort of gamma AAB is just equal to a half the trace, or rather G delta G. And so in that case, I can re-express this since I'm contracting on n. That just gives me the covariant derivative along n of delta g. So now I just look at these terms, and I've got to take the derivative in turn of everything inside the brackets. Let me just write the first term because it just comes along for the ride for a bit. So first of all, this covariant derivative hits n, so I get minus a half k nb nc delta gbc. Then the covariant derivative hits delta g. And then when the covariant derivative hits either of these two normals, I get the extrinsic curvature, but I'm contracting on this A index, so n dot k is zero, so I don't get anything when my extrinsic curvature hits these middle two normals. Now, if I just look in here, this n, if you remember, my induced metric is g plus nn. So this is just going to be h minus g. Actually, hang on. That's true, but it's not the particular pair of n's that I wanted to replace. So let me look at this a bit more in detail. Nb and c and a grad a delta gbc. What I'm actually doing with this is I'm kind of got one eye on the second term inside that variation, the boundary term. And so here I can see I've got a derivative of delta G, but what I really want is, and I've also got NB, but I want to replace this NCNA with HCA minus delta CA. So the very first term is the first term in that bracket. So that's good news. The last term is the second term in my variation of on the boundary. So I've already got something that looks right. That's the first and last terms. And then I've got to look at the middle two terms. So here, minus a half k nn. And then this term, I'm reversing the order of derivatives by pulling that n inside. And so I have to take the derivative of n. So that's the last two pieces here. So if I now look at the variation of this boundary term, k root g, so the variation of the square root of the metric combines with this term here to give me KHAB.
Mm-hmm. When you write the K square root of G in B3X, is that G the original metric or the metric in the boundary?
So it's the metric in the boundary, yeah. But when I'm sort of looking at varying that, it's basically that the variation of that boundary metric it's really that this term here combines with that, so that the two together give me the right expression for the Israel equation. So it is the metric restricted to the boundary. So what I've written down here is the variation of this term, the extrinsic curvature term. You see that there's a total derivative here lying within the boundary. And because I'm already on a boundary, that boundary has no boundary. Therefore, that term can be taken away. This term, in terms of my variational principle of the Einstein-Hilbert action, this is now proportional to delta G, so that's good because we want to make sure that a boundary term only depends on the variation of the metric on the boundary. And the second piece is exactly what we need to cancel off the derivatives coming from the variation of the bulk action. So this tells us that overall, if I add on this extra piece, which is the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, then my variational principle is now completely sensible. I'm not cheating anymore. I'm really using the fact that the variation of my metric on the boundary, restricted to the boundary, vanishes.
So about how the terms cancel, does something funny happen?
Have I got a wrong sign or something?
No, because you're, if this root g is the root g restricted to the boundary, but in the above equation, I guess, it's like it's in the board. I guess I'm confused that the root g's don't match up. On the top board, it says recall delta SEH, and then in the second line, that D3X root G. Was that also the metric?
Yeah, so in each, so right root H, if you like. I think that was how we wrote it. It's because we were sort of think at the time we hadn't introduced Gauss-Kadatze. So it's really in all cases when you're doing the variation of the action on the boundary, you're looking at objects on the boundary. I mean, yeah. It should really be root H, but I guess I'd written root G up there initially because that was what we did initially because we hadn't done this formalism. So actually, if we look at just revisiting the Israel equations, we can see that, in fact, those are now quite trivial because if I look at the variation of the Gibbons-Hawking term, I get, if I look at what's proportional to delta G, let me draw a picture first.
Okay, so if you take the variation of this new action on the first term, I got the Einstein equations. On the other term, I get the Israel equations.
Mm-hmm.
Are both equations independent of each other or not?
They're all part of a sort of broader set of Einstein equations. So you need to be able to solve both the bulk equations and the boundary equations. Now, whether or not they're independent of each other, in general, actually not. It kind of depends on the situation. So for example, if you're trying to solve for a domain wall, the first thing you have to do is really sort, well, first thing you have to do is think about what are the symmetries, what's the metric going to look like? So you're really answering, how do I describe M plus, how do I describe M minus? So that's the first thing you do. Then once you've got M plus and M minus, you identify the boundary, which is going to be your wall. And so typically you'll choose coordinates. As a first step, you tend to choose coordinates where the wall looks nice. Then you solve for the bulk, if you can, on each side. Then you compute the extrinsic curvatures of the boundaries, and then you try and match up the boundary equations of motion. So you tend to do it step by step. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the bulk looks nice, and the boundary is just a slice of the bulk. But if you want to look at a more sort of general situation, I mean, it's not really that the two are independent, because if this thing is not a nice submanifold, you know, some sort of maximally symmetric type of submanifold of your manifold, and typically if it's sort of flapping all over the place, it's going to produce effects in the manifold by gravitational radiation. So typically there is some interaction. So, but the fully dynamical case is too difficult to treat sort of in an exact analytic or even exact way. So what you typically do is you find these nice solutions and then perturb them. So that's what you typically do. So here, if I look at delta S equals zero, so my action is going to be Einstein-Hilbert plus, Einstein-Hilbert minus, Gibbons-Hawking plus, Gibbons-Hawking minus, and then you're going to have plus a sort of ball or matter action, which is something which is just restricted to the submanifold sigma. So if I'm looking at just this, where my only matter is the wall itself, if I look at delta S equals zero, I get my Einstein equations in the bulk. And then my variation of the boundary terms will give me So this is what I get, but then I have to notice, of course, that from an Israel perspective, the normal on the minus side has been flipped. So my right-hand side is really 1 over 16 pi g delta kab minus delta k hab from an Israel perspective. And on the left-hand side, I've got a half the energy momentum tensor of the wall, which is really SAB. So that gives me the Israel equations straight away without really having to do any work, except of course we had to do all the work to argue that the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term was the right term. So I just want to go through another example, which is going to be very, very brief now because I'm running out of time. But one of you foolishly asked me last night if I was going to talk about Randall Sundrum. So I thought, right, in honor of the Harvard students, let me talk about Randall Sundrum. So this is my second example. Which is the Randall-Sundrum model. And this is a domain wall. So when I say domain wall, I mean that I've got some sort of energy momentum tensor proportional to the metric, at least to a leading order approximation. And this domain wall lives in five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space-time. So the solution, I'm just going to write down what the solution is and then demonstrate that that's plausible. So I've written anti-de Sitter space with a particular slicing. Here, mu runs from 0, 1, 2, 3. And so Z is my fifth dimension. Notice it's Z2 symmetric because I've got a mod Z here. So what I've got here is one of those warp space times, which I talked about when I talked about the domain wall, I kind of tried to derive the Einstein tensor for this general shape, although we had a G in front of this part. So you've seen this type of metric, and the energy momentum tensor of the wall explicitly is proportional to this induced metric here. The wall sits at Z equals zero. You can see there's a sort of kink in the warp factor there. So this thing here we call warp factor. So this is not Star Trek. The warp factor here is just something that tells us how space is distorted. And our energy momentum tensor of the wall is something very specifically related. This K is the curvature scale, or the inverse curvature length of anti-de Sitter space. So for M plus here, N is d by dz. So K is just, again, this connection component. And if you work out what that is, it's minus k eta mu nu. So that tells me that delta k mu nu is minus 2k eta mu nu. Delta k is minus 8k. So if I look at my Israel equations, it all works. So that's the basic Randall-Sundrum solution. And so why was Randall-Sundrum, why did it attract a lot of interest? Well, they didn't really look at this from a gravitational perspective. In fact, this particular setup had been considered back in the 1980s by Rubikoff and Shaposhnikov, who'd written down this exact type of, or the, this sort of solution. They'd been thinking about our universe as a domain wall. That's what the paper's called, Our Universe as a Domain Wall. But there, people had explored more this notion of localization. So when you have this, sorry, Lucien, by the way, I started very late, so just give me 5 minutes. If you have one of these localized non-perturbative solutions in field theory, you can generate masses for particles. So if you sort of couple in additional fields, you find that you have this strange situation where outside the wall, your particles can be very heavy, but inside the wall, they're very light. So if you think about this from that perspective of symmetry breaking, inside the wall, your symmetry is restored because you had this Z2 symmetry. Outside the wall, it's broken. So we're kind of used to the notion of broken symmetry giving masses to particles. So that's sort of the idea, that you could get very light particles confined to a brain and heavy, whereas they would stay on the brain because they're very heavy in the bulk. So that was their initial notion, but it was not particularly, you know, fully developed. Whereas sort of, I suppose, 15 years ago now, this idea of having extra dimensions came about to give some alternative way of describing the hierarchy between the gravitational interaction and our particle physics interactions. So just very briefly, even though this looks a bit wacky, what we've got is a wall sort of sitting here. We've got anti-de Sitter space out here. We've got this warp factor with a kink. And we've got an infinite extra dimension. How can that possibly correspond to our universe with our Einstein gravity? I'm not going to give the full argument. I'm just going to give a sort of very rough and ready type of justification. So I'm going to say here, my KAB this is what my expression for KAB is, and I'm then going to write SAB is going to equal my Randall-Sundrum SAB. Plus an extra little piece. So if I look at my Gauss equation, which we derived earlier, and input what my various Riemann terms are, so the notion here is what I'm going to do is I know what this term is because I'm in ADS5. This has just come from ADS5. And I know my k's because my k's are given in terms of the energy momentum tensor. So I end up here so I simply input for the extrinsic curvatures in terms of the background stress energy plus this little perturbation, delta T. And then if I sort of look at the various terms, if I look at the order one terms, I've got plus 3k squared there. Here I've got minus 4k squared. And then if I look at the final bit, I've got another plus k squared. So my order one terms actually vanish on the right-hand side. And then if I look at the order delta T terms, you can see I've got a delta T sitting here multiplied by, here I've got 16 pi gk. And then I've also got a delta T here coming from cross terms. So I've got a delta T times minus 4 pi gk, and I've got that twice. So I end up with 8 pi gk delta t. And then when I look at the trace terms, and I'm just claiming this because I'm kind of running out of time here. You can check the factors. So what I actually end up with is my a sort of Einstein equation for my intrinsic Ricci tensor, which is to leading order dependent on this delta T. So this G here was really G5, So I now say this is 8 pi g4, where g4 is g5k. But notice the thing that's most important is that factor sitting in there of a half. When we reverse Einstein's equations, as I did right at the beginning on that top board, the correct structure that I get in four dimensions is t del tab minus a half t gab. That's the right structure for a massless graviton. If I was just looking in five dimensions, it would be minus a third. If I was looking at a massive graviton, at least to leading order in four dimensions, it would still be minus a third. So there's a piece of magic that's happened here, which is that everything conspires to give you to leading order, not just something that's got like a Newtonian potential, but that actually has the right spin structure for gravity in four dimensions, so that our gravitational field is a massless spin two field to leading order. So that's not how Randall and Sundrum did it. What they did was to look at perturbations around that background. So they did a proper linearization of gravity around that background and looked at what the excitations were and showed that the zero mode, which was four-dimensional, looked like a four-dimensional massless spin two field. So, you know, that was really the key to why their model became so popular, because it's a way of compactifying or giving an extra dimension where it doesn't have to be small, but nonetheless, the graviton is confined. Okay, sorry about the sort of scramble being late.